show that looks at Kansas City baseball's past, present, and future.
High fly ball. Motley going back to the track. No outs to go. The Royals have won the 1985 World Series.
Davis comes to the plate. Strike three called. It's over. They've done it. The Royals are World Series champions. The world champion Kansas City Royals.
This is the Kansas City Baseball Vault.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome in to the Kansas City Baseball Vault, brought to you by Kelly's Westport Inn, a Baseball Prospectus affiliate. Folks, we don't have any Royals baseball to talk about, but we got some baseball to talk about, so we'll do that. How does that sound? Sounds good to me. Glad we could have this talk. Before we get into all of that, of course, I am Jeff Herr. With me, as always, is the man who never has an off season, Michael Engel. Mike, how are you doing on this? As you told me before the show, I guess you were talking about the on TV. It's rainy in Chicago, but is it?
Yeah.
You didn't say it was rainy in Lawrence, is it? Because it's
nah.
No, it's okay. Because nah, it's been kind of like nice. Off and on in Kansas City, so.
I mean, it might be. My blinds are closed, so I don't know. I don't want the neighbors to get jealous about my podcast set up at my kitchen table, so I got to keep the blinds closed.
It's an important concern.
I know. I'm on the second floor, too, so they got to really work to see it. So it's just like, no, not today. Not today, you...
not today.
You crazy people out in the courtyard.
Crazy podcast stalkers.
Right. Right, that's... Yeah, I don't think that's a thing that exists.
That's not a thing that exists. Yeah. That doesn't happen.
That's making stuff.
What does happen, regardless of whether or not the Royals are participating, is playoff baseball. That's currently going on. No need to really go too in-depth. I don't know that too many people really care, but just kind of a rundown. Astros eliminated the Boston Red Sox 3-1. We've got, the Cubs-Nationals game yesterday was postponed. Today they're playing. Looks like the Nationals are about to take out the Cubs. Or not, or the first night, of course, which would force a game 5.
Yep.
And then the Yankees and Cleveland series is tied at 2-2. And they'll play tonight in just a few short minutes. They'll throw out first pitch there. And let's see, what did I miss? The Dodgers swept the Diamondbacks 3-0. So the could be – so right now we've got two games that look like – or two games, two series that look like one definitely with New York and Cleveland is going to a game 5, and then looks like we're headed there with the Nationals-Cubs. Game 5 possibility, and then the winner of those two series, of course, will go on to play the Astros and the Dodgers, respectively. And this is one of those years that has seemingly gone kind of full chalk, if you will. Dodgers, best team in baseball all season, end up, they're in the NLCS pretty much no problem. The Astros were the best American League team pretty much all season. Cleveland, those last couple months, many would argue were better, and they ended up having the number one seed, but Houston was more consistent over the years. So that's, there's an argument to be made. I think there was only one game difference between the two of them. So there's an argument to be made, I guess. I probably shouldn't say they were the best because they obviously weren't the number one seed, but I think many would argue that they were probably still the best team in the American League, but
without a historic winning streak, they were the best team.
Yeah, exactly.
So,
and we already discussed without that winning streak, they were exactly the same as the Royals. So, I mean,
right.
But anyway, regardless, they could be playing each other, or it could be Houston, New York. So, nothing has really kind of. I mean, there have been some good moments. so far in the postseason. Maybe they don't feel as good because it's not my team, you know. Maybe somebody's sitting in L.A. in 2015 and was like, yeah, that was kind of cool that Lorenzo Cain went from first to home.
But
during that play, and you know, like, yeah, Hosmer made a boneheaded move that worked out by trying to go home on a throw to first, and it, you know, okay, I guess. So maybe that's you know, it's just because it's not my team, but some solid moments. But it seems like kind of the most interesting thing so far about the playoffs is kind of the pitching and how it's been used and utilized by managers. And interestingly enough, I don't know that I would say it's come full circle because it wasn't quite like at the beginning of our podcast. But back when we were doing the show on 1510, I remember it was around the 2012 playoffs, and the Nationals at the time were the number one seed in the NL for that season, and they had decided that they were going to shut down Steven Strasburg 1 year removed from his Tommy John surgery. And we were discussing that on show, I remember. Do you remember this?
Kind of. I mean, I remember the Strasburg situation. I remember them shutting him down. I don't know that I remember what we talked about specifically, but
it was more or less just, would you do it? You know, would you risk shutting down Strasburg and losing in the playoffs like they did?
Yeah.
Or would you just say, you know, we're going to possibly sacrifice future health of our star player, knowing that this is a once in a lifetime opportunity? And, you know, they hadn't been that good since until this year. But even now, you look and they're as good as they were in 2012, but they're kind of, if they do advance to the NLCS, they're going to come up against a buzzsaw in the LA Dodgers, one of the best teams in years that the Major League Baseball has seen. So, you know, you never know. But the reason I bring that up, though, is because, and I say it's kind of like full circle, is because recently, meaning like explicitly recently, like the last day or so, Steven Strasburg has kind of been in the center of some more pitching contention. You know, he was supposed to pitch. He had the flu or some sort of sickness. And yeah. Then
there's something about mold. I didn't really catch. Yeah, I don't know.
Sniffles were mentioned possibly. So he didn't pitch when he was scheduled to, and then now he pitches today and in a very pivotal game 4 against the Cubs facing elimination, he pitches 7 shutout innings. He does very well.
Yeah.
So those sniffles were, he got over it rather quickly. Maybe it was one of them 24-hour bugs, but
right.
Nobody quite knew what the situation was and why he wasn't started. Dusty Baker was being kind of vague, throwing out just like not really giving an answer while giving answers. Very Ned Yosty of him.
But, answers,
yeah. But that's just kind of the most recent thing. Others have involved, you know, when relievers or starters have been used. You know, Justin Verlander gets thrown in what inning did he get thrown in? Like fourth or fifth inning? I can't remember.
Yeah, and it was just in the middle of the inning. It's not like he started in – he came in the middle of an inning, which is – I think I saw somebody tweet out that it was the first time in his adult life that had happened, like going back through even high school, that he just had not done that. And it's like – okay, that's just really weird decision making. So it's just that, and that's just like the tip of the iceberg for some of the weird stuff so far.
Yeah, and you know, was that? Let's see, did they end up winning that game? I can't remember.
I think that was game 4.
Was that the game 4 clincher? Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was.
So it worked, but if it hadn't, I mean,
yeah, but
now
I mean,
you're
in gave
game
up,
5 and you don't have him available.
Yeah, and he gives up that home run and everything. So, you know, almost shades of Yordano Ventura in the wild card game in 2014 coming in and getting knocked around and possibly, you know, could that – I mean, we were talking if the Royals lost that game, firing Ned Yost for that specific reason. I mean, that was the time. Right. I remember on Twitter, that was what people were yelling about when that was happening. So, you know, it worked out, like you said, for the Astros. But, yeah, just a very kind of perplexing decision there. And it feels like with the last couple of years, what we've seen specifically, you know, 2014, 2015 Royals, and then last year, 2016, you saw the Cubs and how, you know, they rode Aroldis Chapman, and you saw Cleveland, how they rode Andrew Miller, and both those teams, you know, riding the, on top of those, their collective bullpens in general, to the postseason success that they had. It's almost like teams are, okay, we're just, that's how you do it. That's how it's done now. With the postseason, you essentially pull all the stops. It's not five starters and seven or eight relievers, however many you have. It's 12, 13, 14 pitchers on your roster, and everybody needs to be ready to go at every time unless you just pitched yesterday as a starter. It's kind of, it kind of feels like how they're doing it. Even if you just pitched yesterday, who knows, we might still need you, depending on the scenario. But, you know, in one hand, I kind of like that some of the managers and baseball in general, I guess you could say, is slightly – I don't want to say it's evolving. I don't want to give them too much credit. Right. But just a little bit of a little bit of change in terms of how – realizing that the playoffs, like it or not, are different than the regular season. So it's not worth, you know, sticking with your guy if that person's not working. You know, like just ask Terry Collins – about sticking with Matt Harvey, right? Like, it doesn't matter. It's not worth it because you could lose a World Series. So, you know, if there's an opportunity, and if you're, it's almost like, you know, during the regular season, a coach may just, a manager may say, well, maybe I should get him now. I'll let him ride this out. See how he deals with one person on base. Okay, we got another person on base, but there's, you know, one out. Maybe we get a double play, whatever. It's almost like as soon as they ask that question now, since they're in the playoffs, managers are just like, just go. Get the guy. Get the new guy in. And like I said, I'm not terribly – I don't think it's a terrible change if that's kind of the new norm, if you will. But at the same time, just because you have the pitchers available and you think a switch should be made, you know, you still need to make the right switch and make it kind of at the right time in the right situation. And – like I said, even though it worked out for Verlander, you know, I think you could – a lot of people did argue that that wasn't necessarily the right position to put him in. So, you know, who knows, I guess. But yeah. has there been anything else that stuck out at you with the playoffs here?
Well, some of the whole deal with pitching is just that, you know, you get stuff like you know, Chris Sale gets hammered and Ervin Santana in the wild card game gives up a bunch of runs, and Luis Severino in that wild card game gives up a lot of runs, and Corey Kluber had a bad start. So you get to a point where there's the managers are working with a lot of urgency to make those changes just when it's clear someone's not, you know, working out. And, you know, to an extent, you know, there are all these built-in travel days and days off, so it does give them a little more leeway to lean on a relief pitcher if they need a couple of innings. But in some cases, it's like David Price coming out of the bullpen for like four innings, or David Robertson in that wild card game worked over three innings, and I don't think he's ever done that in his career. It's kind of like you find the hot hand and you just lean on him and you just go tell, okay, you really can't go anymore. Some of that I think ends up coming from, you know, we talk about the third time through the order and the penalty, how teams usually will hit a starter the third time through better because fatigue of the starter, and they've seen pretty much all of their pitches at that point. So it tends
it tends to be
that starting pitchers the third time through start to get hit. And, you know, you'll notice that that starts to happen in the fifth or sixth inning. And so if you're ready with relievers at that point, then, yeah, you can kind of hand it off. You're looking for 27 outs, and if your starter can get you 15 or 18 of them, you feel pretty good. And that was the blueprint for the Royals in 2014 and 2015. It's just get through six and hand it off. And it worked. It worked great. But there are certain times where you just have to kind of call upon a guy to work a little bit more. And this time of year, there's no real second chances unless you're the Royals a couple of years ago. It's just like you don't really get into a position where, okay, maybe something can work out. You kind of have to get the outs right there when you can and just do whatever it takes to get them and consider that you've got all winter to rest up. And, you know, it's probably part of what Terry Collins was thinking in game five with Harvey. And you'll remember in game five that Kelvin Herrera went three innings because it was just like, okay, let's just get this done now. And
yeah, and in fairness to Terry Collins, I like to joke because of how it turned out, but Matt Harvey was pitching.
He was pitching great.
He was so. The Royals had no answer for him.
Yeah. I don't blame him, really.
I don't ever blame Terry Collins for putting him back out there. He might have left him out there a tad bit too long, but I don't blame him for putting him out there. But I like to make fun of him for it, though, because it's easy to do when the Royals win.
Yeah, so. Basically. Yeah. So I don't know if it's – I mean, we saw last year with the usage of, Andrew Miller and Cody Allen with the Indians – that Francona was really aggressive with using them and would use them for much longer than you would in the regular season. And there was some thought of, oh, maybe this is the new thing. And it still isn't. You've still got a lot more to kind of work with throughout the season and a lot more to keep an eye on. So, I don't think it's going to usher anything in. But it is kind of something where Yu Darvish the other night was pitching really, really well. And he hits like 70 pitches and starts to falter a little bit and boom, right there, quick hook. So they're getting to a point where when you're in sight of that end goal to finish off a game, managers are pretty aggressive. And, when you look at these teams, the Cubs have Wade Davis, the Dodgers have Kenley Jansen, there's Andrew Miller, there's Ryan Madsen and Sean Doolittle with Washington and, all these really strong relievers, Chapman, of course, on the Yankees, David Robertson, Tommy Conley. When you've got those kind of arms, sure. It's why would you not go to Herrera, Davis, and Holland if you have them available? So I think that plays into it, too. If these were just kind of scrub relievers, you might see some of those starters trying to work it out. But I also think managers are more willing to just kind of make that change when you've got a really high power arm who can come in those high leverage situations. And, you kind of have the peace of mind knowing that those guys are going to get the outs. So it's interesting to see it. It's, I don't think it's anything you'll see going forward, except maybe in short stretches, but, for the playoffs, it's kind of all hands on deck and managers are willing to pull the trigger when they need to. So, it makes it kind of fun. It makes the games longer, but it's fine. It's baseball. It's playoff baseball. No one's turning the channel. So
where else you got to be?
Right. Exactly.
So
sorry.
That's kind of what's that's what's going on. That's the end of that. There we go. That's what's going on in the world of baseball right now. But to bring it back a little bit more Royals focused. We kind of talked last week was our farewell podcast, if you will, to the four major players who have so defined this organization for the last 6 years now, going back to 2011, between Eric Hosmer, Mike Moustakas, Lorenzo Cain, Alcides Escobar. Now, one of the things we mentioned but didn't really get too deep into was the possibility of one or more of these players coming back to the Royals next year. We all assumed, and I mean, this even goes for when they were young players coming up through the system and when they first arrived, it was pretty much seemed like it was a foregone conclusion for most Royals fans that Eric Hosmer would be a Yankee in 2018 and Mike Moustakas would be gone and all these different things. So we've kind of known about this for a while, obviously, but the difference now between, the context of 2011, of course, was that the Royals had the lowest payroll in baseball. Was it like $35 million, $40 million, somewhere in there?
Yeah. It was pretty low. They were a lot of rookies and a lot of lucky kind of minor league deal signings that they hit on.
Yep. And not to mention that was the year that Gilmesh decided in his infinite grace that he would just give back. We didn't give back because he never earned it, but he just would not accept payment for the final year of his contract, which is completely unheard of, you know?
Right.
And, I mean, while I think it's like pretty cool from like a nice guy standpoint that he did it.
Pretty stupid.
Why? I would have, I would have just been like, oh man, my arm really hurts. I can't go today. Sorry. And just hung around for a year, taken my $12 million and peaced out, you know. But hey, that's his prerogative. Good for him. Thanks, Gil. But right. That's neither here nor there. Point being, that's the context of the year in 2011. So you think never, no chance of hiring Hosmer. The only reason they could even feasibly keep him for the next 6 years is because the rookie contract structure is made to so that any team can essentially afford it. But then things started happening. Rose started winning. And just like David Glass promised he would, he pumped more money into this organization. So now you get to 2016 or 2017 where the Royals have $130, $140 million payroll. And now it's like, well, wait a second. You know, maybe they actually can afford to hire one or to sign one of these guys back onto the team. You know, even though it's going to cost a big deal of money, you know, if the Royals are in the top half of the league now in payroll and, you know, by quite a bit, and they're not a bottom third team, then all of a sudden this becomes a little bit more feasible, a little bit more realistic. So the question becomes, though, because even if you're in the camp that, hey, the Royals can afford to do this for one of their players, I don't know anybody who's in the camp of the Royals can afford to do this for all four of those players. That certainly can't be done. Yeah. I mean, the Royals' payroll next year is committed as of today is somewhere around $90 million, and just to sign those four, I mean, you're probably looking at, I mean, $70 million if you wanted to sign all four of those. So right there, you're pricing yourself out.
Right.
But there's, you know, so the Royals, as many would assume, would have to target who they really want out of those. And I don't think there's been any you know, misconceptions or anything. Hosmer's the guy. That's the guy they want. He's the guy with the seemingly highest ceiling, the most potential, even still, and always kind of did have the most potential. He's the face of the franchise. He's the guy that handles the media. We talked about it ad nauseum last week about all the great things that Hosmer does, both on and off the field. So, you know, can the Royals feasibly do this? And Sam Ehlinger wrote an article in the Kansas City Star about this and how, you know, the Royals are all in on Hosmer, and they're going to try and make this work with him. And if they do, then they're going to try and kind of fill in around him as best they can and possibly use him to convince maybe one of those other players to sign back with the Royals, you know, with the Lorenzo Cain or Mike Moustakas. So, you know, who knows what could happen there, but it's almost, you know, they're kind of thinking, okay, if we can get Hosmer, we can get a couple other dominoes to fall into place, you know, payroll is going to be high, but it's going to be manageable. And then maybe we can keep this train rolling, even though it's kind of sputtering out already, even with Hosmer and the whole rest of the crew. So it's, you know, it's kind of one of those things where it's obviously not the same because Hosmer is not a closing pitcher. But, you know, those years when Soria was so good and we talked about, you know, what's it really, you know, having a good closer on a bad team, you know, kind of the lipstick on a pig argument, if you will. It's like, if it'd be great to have Hosmer here, you would rule the town. Everybody would love him. You know, he'd probably end up one of the both statistically and just through memory would be one of the best Royals play. Like the way he would be remembered by fans after spending so many years, you know, he'd be one of the best and most beloved Royals players most likely. But, you know, it'd essentially be, you know, the last 10 years of George Brett's career, right? Like,
yeah, you're just not really getting a lot done.
He did some great things. He won a, you know, batting title, all-star games, all that business. But, you know, what does anybody really remember about the 85 through 94 Royals, you know? I mean, the most memorable thing is, you know, making the trades to get, they had Storm Davis and Mark Davis, the both Cy Young winners on the team at the same time. And that didn't pan out.
No, God.
You know, they had a couple good seasons. And but they still didn't make the playoffs because they didn't have wild cards back then. So, you know, it's that's the way it worked. So, I mean, and the last, you know, 4 or 5 years of George Brett's career was just him being on, you know, middling teams. Is that what you want for Eric Hosmer? Because it's kind of that double-edged sword. Yeah, you'd love to have him back. He's going to cost a lot of money. But if you can get him for the money that you're going to pay – you're hamstringing yourself in terms of actually being able to utilize his talents appropriately. Because if it's just a bunch of guys in Hosmer, then it's just a bunch of guys in Hosmer.
Right.
And Hosmer's worked so well because he's hitting in between Lorenzo Cain and Mike Moustakas and Salvador Perez. And, you know, there was Kendrys Morales before Brandon Moss and, you know, all these different things that went into Hosmer's success. But if you strip all that away and now it's like, oh, well, we could pitch to Raul Mondesi and Chester Cuthbert and Jorge Bonifacio and just pitch around Eric Hosmer. That is a much easier proposition than saying, oh, man, we have to pitch to Kane and we have to pitch to Moose and then we still have to worry about Hosmer. So it's a bit of a different scenario, you know, if you look at it that way. And if you can't fill those holes in, it doesn't really do much for you. I don't know. So, you know, I kind of always come from the standpoint of, you know, keeping the band together, strictly to keep the band together, is not necessarily always the best idea, especially if you're not really keeping the band together. You're just, you know, keeping
it's the, like, the front man. And
yeah, you know, if Mick Jagger rolled out there with like three other dudes, you know, like, sure, you know, it'd be like Mick Jagger and you'd be the voice and everything, but you'd be kind of like, you know, who are these other guys? Like, what's going on here? So I don't know. I mean, how do you, when you read that article, you talk about Royals making a big move to try and re-sign Hosmer. How do you feel about that? What does it make you feel?
Well, I'd love to have Hosmer back from a fan standpoint. And, you know, he's been one of my favorite players to ever wear a Royals uniform. But the premise alone, I just don't think they're going to be able to sign him. I think in that same article there was a caveat that they would really need the market to filter itself out so that he would only be like $150 million total contract value, which that might be around where he's at, but you're trying to, like, one, you know, he's got the reputation. He's coming off a career year. You know, he's one of the, you know, he's at the right age where the next 4 years are probably going to be his most productive, most likely. So you've got a lot of teams out there that could definitely use a first baseman who can hit for average and work a walk occasionally and has a defensive reputation and has power that seems to be improving. That's pretty good. So, you know, if he's going to make $25 million over 6 years, that's kind of where the Royals have to be able to get him. And that's a lot. You know, $25 million is going to be a lot for a team like the Royals that, you know, they've still got Brandon Moss's second year and Jason Hamill's second year, and they've got an increase for Danny Duffy, and Sal Perez's contract is going to start to escalate as well, and Alex Gordon's going to get $20 million. And, you know, they've got a lot of payroll commitments just going into next year, and that's without signing anybody else. That's without re-signing Hosmer. And then the next step is you have to somehow get these other guys, you know, either Kane or Moustakas. And it's like, that's pretty difficult too. So it's like, you kind of have to start with the idea that the, like $18 million is like a floor for those guys, because they're going to get the qualifying offer from the Royals. And, you know, maybe next year they won't make exactly $18 million, but it's probably going to average out to around there for any of those three guys. So that's going to be really difficult to pay $24, $25 million for one and $18 million for another when you've got other spots to fill. You know, they're going to have to replenish the bullpen somehow. And there's You know, they'll need some depth, and you know, there's not a lot of guys in their minor league system who can come up and do that. And if the Royals don't want to do a full scrap it down rebuild like the Cubs did a few years ago, or the Astros kind of did a couple years ago, then it's going to be really difficult for the Royals to kind of do both of those things, keep the guys they want to and contend, or, you know, they're just going to end up in a position where they're paying a lot of guys for about three or four rebuilding years, and maybe by that fifth year, maybe they'll be good again. But I don't know. I mean, I would like to see them re-sign those guys, but I don't think that it's going to work out. I mean, they're already at $90 million before you consider arbitration guys and what other signings and, you know, what other buyouts you've got to work out, and, you know, other contracts on the books. I think they still owe some money for Travis Wood and whatever. So
I'm sure Omar Infante still is owed some money.
I think it's finally dropped off.
I know. I think
maybe.
But
still, it's like you're really kind of stuck where it's really difficult to sign this guy you want and have the opportunity to fill in the other spots with anything other than kind of replacement level guys. So it's going to be a heck of a trick. But the first part of that, the first step of all of that, is get Hosmer. And to get Hosmer, you need some conditions too. You know, the Yankees, maybe they're not in on him anymore. Greg Bird seems to be playing pretty well for them. If he's going to be their first baseman of the future, then yeah, they wouldn't be in on Eric Hosmer. They also said that they want to try to stay under the tax threshold. So that might keep them from blowing the bank on Hosmer. But there are other teams, and I think a team that's anyway iffy on their first baseman situation would be looking at Hosmer. So it's you know, he's going to have suitors for him, and if the Royals want to get him, they might get maybe a slight discount just for the sake of being Kansas City. But it's Scott Boras. You know, how often is he going to take a discount unless his player is just adamant about doing it? And it's tough to be Eric Hosmer and be adamant to take a discount to walk into what is kind of a halfway rebuilding situation. So the first step, I just don't see how it happens. And even if it does, I don't know that it's necessarily the best thing for the Royals from the standpoint of fielding, you know, any kind of good team next year or over the next few years. You know, it'd be nice to have him. And if you do get some development out of Bonifacio, Winchester, Cuthbert, and if Mondesi figures it out, and if you happen to get some pitchers that develop and come through, then yeah, maybe. But those are a lot of things that have to go right. It's a lot of ifs. And, you know, if you're relying on ifs, it's kind of difficult to actually get where you need to go. So I don't think anything's going to happen, but it's definitely interesting to kind of see that as a thought, because I could definitely see it where Hosmer signed and could convince one of those guys to come back. I probably Moose, because it's Hosmer Moustakas, but it's pretty tough to see it actually working out that way.
Yeah, and you know. And we got Salvador Perez would still be here too, yeah. As would Gordon. So, you know, there's some additional convincing power, if you will. But, you know, I agree that it's not – when you look at, you know, what's best for the organization, as great as it would be to have Hosmer still, yeah, I'm inclined to agree with you that it's just – it's probably not the right move overall, because, you know, it's – you need to kind of – move on. You know, if you can't keep that whole crew together, then, you know, there was a symbiosis there, if you will, you know, between all those guys that, you know, permeated through the locker room and through the rest of the team. And, you know, Hosmer was obviously the face of this team for these last few years, but those guys kind of at the top, if you will, you know, Hosmus, Kane and Escobar, and Gerard Dyson, when he was still here too, was kind of, even though he wasn't as prominent on the field, but they kind of set the tone even beyond just Hosmer himself. It was kind of those groups and Salvi and Gordon in there as well. So, you know, that was kind of for all the other, you know, 18, 20 guys in the team would kind of take their cue from them. But, you know, it's since if you can't keep all that together and it's just it would just be Hosmer and you know, Salvi would still be here, of course, but then it's best to probably just kind of to break free. So
and if he signs anywhere else, they're going to get a draft pick. So
yeah, absolutely.
You know, you get a bank that later. So that could be the next Hosmer. And in 4 years, that draft pick turns out to be, you know, an affordable young first baseman who hits to all fields.
Hey, look at that.
That would be nice. Or, you know, whatever position. So
yeah, you know, whatever. And but now, you know, it can kind of transition. It's Salvi's team now. You know, that's how it is.
Mm-hmm.
So that's totally fine. You know, it's a new era, if you will. You can move on and you can, you know, instead of just trying to, you know, there's still going to be a lot of clinging to hope next year for trying to actually compete as a team. But,
Yeah. You
know, if you're, it's hope that doesn't come with any pressure attached to it. It's just kind of like, well, we think this team is going to be bad, but we're going to make some moves and, you know, hopefully we can make a little run at this thing, you
right.
know, but If you bring Hosmer back, say 6 years, $130 million is the contract that you sign, that Hosmer signs for. If that's what you're paying Hosmer, so over $20 million a year to come back, then there is pressure on that team to perform well because of that single contract. So is that really what you want to introduce into this situation? You know, because you know it's going to be rough, and one player is not going to save you or help you for next season. And, you know, I'm kind of overselling how bad the team's going to be because they're not going to be that bad. But, you know, just to make a point, however good or bad they're going to be.
They were 80-82 this year, and they had all those guys.
Yeah, so when they lose, if they lose every one of them except for Hosmer, you know, if they're a 75-win team – without Hosmer and all the rest of those guys next year, what does Hosmer make them? 77, maybe 78 win team,
yeah.
You know, like what's your real benefit there? So it's minimal is the answer.
Yeah. They're not at the point where going from 74 to 76, 77 wins is really that big of a difference. If they were like, let's say they were the Twins, and the exact same kind of situation, like let's say you're looking at this guy who's departing and you just lost a wild card game, then yeah, going out and retaining that kind of guy would definitely help because you were right there. And if you can bring him back and everybody else is generally the same, then yeah, those extra wins can really make a big difference. But I just, you know, at this point, it doesn't add that much beyond, you know, the sentimental. And as much as I like that part of it, it doesn't make a lot of sense when everybody around him, other than, you know, a select few, are going to be considered, you know, capable everyday kind of guys.
And we've been here before, right? It was just 2 years ago.
Right.
And his name was Alex Gordon. And the money wasn't as big and the player wasn't as good, but – it was there was that sentimental feeling that, like, you know, and you saw people on Twitter, I don't care what you have to pay him, just pay him. especially after game one in 2015 World Series when he hit that home run in the bottom of the ninth, you know, there's just, you can't let Alex Gordon leave, you just can't do it. And I was I was like half in that camp, and I was like, I understand the reality from the organization standpoint when trying to take the fans into consideration. You can't let Alex Gordon walk. I mean, if he gets some astronomical offer, then okay. But if he gets any sort of reasonable offer, you cannot let him walk. So it put them in a tough situation, even though if I thought maybe they you know, I wanted them to sign him back, but I didn't want it to be too bad. I wasn't too upset with the contract, but it's been terrible.
It looks really bad now.
It looks really bad. So
yeah.
You know, he's a different player than Hosmer, and he was older than Hosmer when he signed it. So hopefully, you know, you wouldn't get that repeat. And as you mentioned, Hosmer should be entering, you know, statistically speaking, what is the prime for an offensive player's career. So if that's the case, you know, then you could be looking at Hosmer's best years ahead of him. And those would probably be worth the 20-some-odd million. But say you get three, you know, say you sign six-year contract, you get three really good years, two okay years, and one bad year, you know.
That's tough.
Yeah. How are you going to feel about that? You know, especially when you're probably backloading a little bit. So those last couple of years, you know, he's probably making 25 or more million right. in those years. Just like Alex Gordon's going to make, what, like 22 million next year or whatever it is. So
yeah, he's at 20, but yeah, it's just done.
At 20, okay. So I think the
darn.
Next year
that $2 million difference.
Yeah, I mean it's a lot of money, and it's money that if he plays like he did this year and last year, it's money that he's not worth, unfortunately. So you don't want to let sentimental feelings get too in the way there. And you know, if I also don't know that if your idea of breaking the bank for someone like Hosmer is to use him then as a recruiting tool to get other players. I don't know how well that works either, because you still right. got to pay those guys. Even if he can convince them to come here, you still got to pay them.
Right.
And, you know, the Royals just aren't getting this money. I don't know where they're thinking that they're going to find the money, but they're not going to have enough to pay enough people to make this team competitive without getting some luck. You know, I kind of
it feels
like the reverse of some of the trades that we've talked about for the 2015 team to get the, you know, when they traded to get Cueto and Zobrist, where would I like to have some of those guys that they traded back? Sure. But I don't care. You know, World Series is great, so I'm fine, you know, I'm fine with it. So it's kind of the same deal. Like, would I love to have Hosmer back next year? Yeah, of course I would. But would I rather the Royals be in a good position to get some more talent that's younger, replenish the system, and build a more sustainable team like they did for the last few years versus try and, you know, cling to that last bit of Royals greatness and maybe hamper themselves for the next few years? You know, I'd much rather they went the route of trying to kind of rebuild from the ground up than try and sacrifice some of that to hold on to this magic they've had. As fun of a ride as it's been, you know, it's time to get off, in my opinion. So it's tough to say that because it
right.
You know, I like Hosmer.
Is yeah, somebody, I'd love to have him back. But he's not going to come back for the minimum. So,
no,
you know, it's just like there's the opportunity cost of what it takes to field the rest of the team, and it just isn't going to work. And, you know, look, the Royals' attendance went down. Their TV ratings, while still very strong locally, went down. They are getting some money from MLB Advanced Media, and eventually there's going to be a new TV contract. But even then, it's still like there's still going to be a low-revenue team, and they're not going to be a team that can go out and sign whoever they want. They've got to, you know, get the guys that make the most sense for them and ideally develop them and have them at those league minimum pre-arbitration numbers and then reasonable arbitration contracts for the last half of their time in Kansas City, like they did with the whole wave that came up in 2011. So that's kind of got to be the approach that they have again, even if it means that you got to let these guys go. It sucks, but that's really the most sensible thing for them. Mm-hmm. Now, fast forward 2.5 months, if they re-sign Eric Hosmer, it's probably going to be a whole different thing.
Right.
I would flip, because I'd be excited that they re-signed Eric Hosmer. Just like I was really excited when they re-signed Alex Gordon. It's like, well,
yeah,
that's how it
goes.
There's
things to be excited about.
I can't help it.
Yeah. Like, you love to see your favorite players play. So if you can see Hosmer every day instead of every, you know, month or so when he would come back to Kansas City, depending on what team he went to, that'd be pretty cool. But it's – and also, you know, just like with Gordon, which was the – you know, biggest contract in Royals history at the time, you know, it's any indication that the Royals are willing to spend money and that they do spend money is awesome, because you know, there was we lived in that world so long where that was so rare for the Royals, and they just did not spend the money that anytime it actually does occur where they do spend it, it's great. But again, you know, I don't know that it's in the best interest of the organization at this point in time. But, you know, I mean, I too would be very happy still probably if they signed him. I mean, what are you going to do?
Right.
You like who you like.
Oh, darn.
Yeah. Oh, no. We get to watch Hosmer for another 6 years.
Not my money, so.
Yeah, exactly.
If they go that way, well, there you go. But I just don't see it working out. I mean, it's just going to be tough to make it work. The other kind of wrinkle is if they do, they would have to probably trade dudes off to make payroll space, which then you're kind of just running in place to accommodate a large contract. So that doesn't make any sense either. That probably makes less sense.
Yeah.
Really, when it gets down to it. So the odds are so slim, but it's nice to kind of think about and tell the inevitable when he and the others sign somewhere else. So
then the flip side of this, if not here, then where? So like, where do you think you kind of talked about, you know, the Yankees or whatever, and you know how they may be not as deep into the market as many thought at the beginning of the year because of Greg Bird playing, you know, well enough, and maybe they think he's the future. But, you know, as far as what we know kind of now is the landscape, and it'll be a little bit different here as the playoffs start to shake out. But, you know, where do you think he ends up landing, if not the Royals?
I don't know. I mean, that's kind of tough to figure out because the Yankees were kind of the obvious team for a long time. But I think very next on the list is probably like Boston. You know, they're going to – you look at like the – I'm thinking big markets, and maybe he's not that guy. You know, who knows? But I think his last 2 years, 25 homers each season, and last year he hit 25 with batting average to go along with it. That makes him pretty attractive for some of these teams. I mean, Boston had Mitch Moreland all year last, you know, this year. So it's not like they were blowing guys away. If they're coming off a disappointing series where they lost to the Astros, John Farrell just got fired today. They're probably looking to be active and make a splash. It's a pretty good situation for Hosmer. He will put dents in that, in the Green Monster.
Yep.
For 81 games a year for 6 or 7 years, and it's got a nice little porch for him to pull the ball and hit it over. So that's probably the ideal fit. I mean, if you're thinking of other big teams like the Angels, they're hampered by Albert Pujols' contract, and he's stuck at first, so I can't see them doing much to move on Hosmer. They're pretty likely to go after Moustakas. The Dodgers don't really have a need there. They've got Cody Bellinger can play there, and Adrian Gonzalez has been there for so long, so I don't think that's going to happen. Anthony DeRizzo's on the Cubs. Houston's probably pretty comfortable. I don't know. I mean, I think Boston's probably it, and he fits a big market. He would probably do very well there, and kind of hold himself pretty nicely. So, I if I had to just pick a team, that would probably be it.
Yeah, and you know, I heard on 810 they had the Trini Kuznarek on there. She's a TV reporter in Boston, and she was kind of talking about because the on the Border Patrol they were asking her about, you know, what's the feeling in Boston, not only from the organization but from the fans around there. Hosmer, is that somebody that they're going to target? Is that somebody they want? And she said that, you know, he's definitely on the radar, is definitely something they're going to look at and explore in terms of signing Hosmer. But she mentioned about how they would maybe be looking for someone with a little power, because the Red Sox, despite all their success this season, they didn't hit a ton of home runs, which is very unlike them. But, I mean, I think the team leader on there, it was like 24 home runs or something. It was very Royals-like
for them.
So that was kind of her, but at the same time, you know, the point that they were making, that I was making in my head in my car with nobody but my daughter to listen to me, was like, okay, if you're hitting 25 home runs in Kauffman, you know, and you're going out to Fenway, you know, that 25 is going to be 30 pretty easily, most likely.
Right.
And probably closer to 35 in a lot of scenarios.
Plus, you're trading Target Field and Comerica Park for Yankee Stadium and Camden Yards.
Yeah.
And then you add Toronto. So, I mean, it's a lot more matchups in home run friendly stadiums, too.
Definitely. So you're looking at quite a bit more production in the home run department, likely, from that scenario. And so, and actually, Mike, in terms of just pure offense, Mike Moustakas might be the best fit for Boston, given his propensity to pull the ball and how the short porch in right field there in Fenway. And I mean, he might hit 50 in Fenway. So,
or New York. I mean,
either one.
He's definitely got the power for that kind of situation.
But anyway, so you know, it'll really be interesting because that with the Yankees really wanting to be under the luxury tax, and like you said, having you know the possibility of Greg Bird being their future there at first base, and then you know the Red Sox, I think they want to try and be under the luxury tax as well, and they also have probably a little bit of a sour taste in their mouth from recent big time signings. You know, the Pablo Sandoval thing backfired majorly. You know, as bad as Alex Gordon's deal has been so far, at least it's not Pablo Sandoval.
Right.
And, you know, on top of that, they have David Price, and that situation has not worked out. He hasn't been as bad as Pablo Sandoval was, but he certainly hasn't been good.
He's not $30 million.
I was about to say, he certainly hasn't been $30 million a year good.
No.
And, you know, he pitched pretty well in his last playoff appearance for them, but that's essentially it that they've gotten from him. And their last few, you know, big major contracts haven't really worked out so well.
Yeah. Hanley Ramirez, not awful, but not very good. You know, so
are they going to want to pump that kind of money into a guy like Hosmer, who, as good as he's been, as good as we think he can be still for a few more years, you know, he's not Mike Trout. He's not Bryce Harper in that sense that
no,
there is that variability there that he hasn't, as good as he's been, that consistency hasn't been there yet. So, because, you know, he has a good year with a high batting average but little home runs. Then he's got a bad year and then, you know, have a good year with lots of home runs but a low batting average. And then a bad year. And then a good, you know, so he's just kind of had that up and down for his whole career. And the last couple of years, you know, the home runs have been there, but the batting average, you know, was low in 2016 and now it was high in 2017. So you don't have that consistency. So there's that added risk there. So, you know, if you're Boston and you're already a little gun shy about giving out a big contract, then you look at Hosmer and you think, okay, the production has been there, but it's been a bit of a rocky road for him. And, you know, who knows, you know, he's got a long swing. He's got a lot of moving parts. He's prone to long slumps. I mean, these things all have to factor in, and they should. So, you know, but then if the Yankees decide they're not in the market for a first baseman and Boston decides they don't want to make that, then where does that leave Eric Hosmer? And from there you look, and it kind of brings up – Sam Ellinger kind of talked about this point in his article about bringing Hosmer back, and he mentioned a very similar scenario with Alex Gordon, where everyone thought Gordon was going to sign for a much larger deal, possibly even $100 million. And Jason Hayward signed with the Cubs, and that kind of set a bunch of dominoes rolling that ended with Gordon not getting as much money as people thought he might and signing back in Kansas City. So if that's where we're at, if the Yankees decide they're not in the market and Boston says that they – don't want to take a risk on Hosmer and they want to stand the luxury tax and they'll try and fill it in otherwise or by other means, you know, then where are we going from there? Then what's Hosmer looking at, you know? And, you know, you already mentioned, you know, Dodgers don't really need a first baseman. I mean, how many teams in the playoffs now, any of the big market teams actually need a first baseman? Not many. So, that's a feasible set of circumstances that could wind up with Hosmer taking less money than some people think that he might, and that the Royals being the person that gives it to him. So, You know, that's your scenario of what has to happen. You know, a little bit more than that, of course, but that's kind of, those are the first two big pieces that have to fall that start the chain reaction that ends with Eric Hosmer being a Royal.
It's not impossible.
No, it's certainly not.
It just does take a lot of things to kind of fit in the place.
Yes. And again, even more willingness on the Rose part as well.
Yeah.
So,
which I think they would be, but it's just a matter of, you know, you still have to make it work. I mean,
they would be, but should they be?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I'd still be excited about it, even if it's a bad decision, but
yeah, definitely. Like we talked about.
Whatever. I'm more fan than anything else. I can't help it, and I'm never going to apologize for it. So,
yeah.
Yeah, I'm not going to get worked up if they signed one of my favorite players to come back. I'll just deal with it.
Yeah.
So,
and you know, if they're a 75 to 80 win team for the next 4 to 5 years because of it, at least we still get to see him play.
Right.
And it'll just be an excuse to constantly talk about that time that he made the mad dash to home on the throw to first.
Still can't believe he freaking did that.
I know.
It just should not have been safe, but whatever.
No, whatever. I'll take
it. Again, bad decision I'm fine with now.
Bad decision, great result.
I'm good with it.
So, and we spent a lot of time talking about Hosmer, so we'll kind of – that's kind of it for that. And do you want to talk about Dayton more now, or do you want to put a pin in that to next week?
We probably ought to bring it up now because it was a thing last week and we were focusing on the other guys. So.
Yeah.
Might as well get it out of the way.
We talked about it a little bit last week, in the midst of our in memoriam, if you will. But lots of rumors. Dayton Moore, Atlanta Braves. They need a GM. Their GM got fired amidst just a tumult of.
Well, he resigned.
Bad.
He resigned in the.
Technically, he resigned. Yes.
Yeah, in that way of do this or you're going to be fired.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. I'll let you save face here.
A coerced resignation, I suppose.
Yeah, no one
advised resignation, let's say.
No one is apparently as awful as he was and does the awful things that he did, and then one day wakes up and says, you know what? I'm a bad person. I need to resign. No one does that. So he was told to do it, is my guess. But anyway, so there's the opening there in Atlanta. And obviously Dayton Moore, lots of history with the Braves, and you have to wonder. So we've kind of talked about this, you know what? And this was a point that Craig Brown brought up in the Slack chat for the VP guys. Like, at what point does Dayton Moore no longer become, or no longer is he an Atlanta guy? And at what point does he become a Kansas City guy? He's got history here, you know, from the area. Mm-hmm. He has all those memories, like when he was hired, we talked about, you know, he talked about like stopping on I-70 to watch the World Series or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
The story that he had,
yeah.
That when he was hired, he told that story, and you know, he brought this team from literally nothing to a World Series. He's a hero in this town, and then, and they've been here for 10 years, you know, more than that, 11 years now, and 11, 12, I guess, depending on when he came, but you know, so his family's got roots here. Like, I don't know how old his kids are, but say he moved here when his kids were, you know, six. Like, you know, they're going off to college now, and they've had basically their entire lives there. Again, I don't know the ages of his kids, you know, so I'm not trying to say.
One of them's on, like, the 17 and under national team or something like that.
Okay, so, yeah, I mean, it just, you know.
Yeah, they've been here a long time.
Yeah, so, you know, if their kid's on 17, then they moved here when, you know, 4 or 5 years old, and this is all they've known. This is their life, is Kansas City. So, and Dayton Moore, having such a strong focus on family as he does, you know, that's something that's important to him. So, and that's a very good question. You know, one that I don't know the answer to. You know, you would think if it's ever going to happen, it would have happened by now. So I guess the answer would be never. You know, there's always that little bit. And there's two kind of things that, and you can probably be with me on this, Mike, as Kansas fans, two examples that can lead us to go either way.
Right.
One is the current example. Everyone thanks Bill Self because he coached at he played at Oklahoma State, and he is from Oklahoma, that any chance he gets to go to Oklahoma, whether it be to coach the Oklahoma City Thunder or to coach Oklahoma State or whatever, that he would take it. Well, Oklahoma State recruited him to try and come back a few years ago after they won the national, after KU won the national championship. I think it was after the second Final Four, actually, that he went to. And he said no, passed on it, said he was happy where he was. And that was kind of his, it was a very matter of fact from at least the way he presented it when asked about it to the media. And it was something that was, you know, very definitive. I'm a Kansas guy now. This is me. Mm-hmm. So that's fine. You know, that's great. But then the flip side is the guy that preceded Bill Self is Roy Williams. Roy Williams in 2000 flirted with North Carolina when that job first came open after Dean Smith retired. And, well, I guess it was Bill Guthridge retiring after, who took over after Dean Smith. But, yeah. And his answer, he stayed at Kansas, but his answer was definitely not as definitive, you know. And he ended up, you know, 3 years later, we all know the story, he ended up leaving. And think of it was, you know, at least as far as how he told the story, you know, something where Dean Smith, his mentor, asked him to come back, was like, come do this, you know, and it's worked out. He was more, he's more successful at North Carolina than he was at Kansas, but, you know, that's neither here nor there. Mm. But the, so there's kind of two, you know, opposing possibilities of where you could be at, because one, you know, the Braves could come calling and Dayton Moore would be like, why would I want to leave? You guys are a mess right now, even though they've got a lot of talent in your system and you're, you know, talent-wise, you're possibly on, you're probably on the upswing. You know, I've built this team up. I can do it again if I want to. You know, the fan base loves me. We won a World Series. I'm going to retire here. This is my life now. Or the other side, the Roy Williams side of this coin, where John Schuerholz, who, you know, a big impact on Dayton Moore's life, one of the men who really kind of ushered him into being a GM.
Yeah, recommended that he talk to the Royals.
So. Absolutely. As the GM of the Braves at the time, Schuerholz did that. So Schuerholz, of course, being a former GM of the Royals in his own right. So, you know, if Schuerholz calls and says, because right now he was the president until last year, because he got promoted essentially from being the GM, Schuerholz did, in 07, to being the president, and then he was served as the president until last year. And now, if I remember correctly, he's like, you know,
he's like a chairman. He's
chairman of the baseball operation. One of the, basically just show up whenever you want and, you know, we'll call you for some input or questions, essentially. So you got to wonder, it's never evolved, I don't think, in day to day, which is fine. But you got to wonder, you know, if Schuerholz makes the call and says, Dayton, we're in a mess right now. It's really bad. We made some bad decisions in the front office. We need to clean this up. You're the guy. I know you can do this. I really need you to, I really need your help on this. You know, what are you going to say? You know, if like I've never been in a position like that where I've had a mentor like that. But if I had someone who was truly one of my, you know, really good friends and a mentor who helped me a bunch and really said, hey, I need you to help me do this, you know, like, I don't know how I say no to that. So I kind of see both sides, but, you know, I don't know. I'm not, that has not happened yet by any account, mm-hmm. by any measure. That's just my supposition of, you know, what's a scenario that could lead to Dayton Moore possibly leaving. And I think it would take a phone call, definitely, if not a full pleading from someone like a John Schuerholz to really make him leave. Cause, you know, otherwise I think it would be hard, but you know, that would be a tough position to be in if you're Dayton Moore and you get, you know, a call from someone who's basically a mentor to you saying, you know, come do this. We need your help.
Yeah. And you've got to tell him no a second time.
Yeah.
That was kind of the thing with Roy Williams, was he couldn't say no the second time. The first time, sure. Second time was like, no, just he had to do it. And I'm, you know, I'm sure it was really difficult for him, and I'm sure it was difficult for Dayton Moore, who had this question a couple of years ago and said no then. And, you know, just, I don't know. I would say 80-20 he would stay with the Royals. I think there is a shot that, hey, maybe he could see that we won the World Series in 2015. There is a rebuild going on. You know, is this something that I can rebuild again almost from scratch? Not quite. They're in a much better situation now than they were when he took over in 2006. But, you know, if he has that opportunity to work with former colleagues and mentors in an organization that is, you know, he's still pretty familiar with, then, yeah, that would be difficult to do. You know, the one thing that really kind of sticks to me, though, is that think about where Dayton Moore is in relationship to ownership in Kansas City. Like, what has he not gotten from David Glass since he's been here? Like, pretty much whatever he's wanted to do. I mean, I guess we know what has happened. We don't know what he's asked for and been told no on. But I think it's safe to say that, you know, when they wanted to rebuild, or not even build, basically build from scratch a Latin American program, boom, you've got academies in the Dominican and in Venezuela and expanded scouting. When you wanted to start signing draft picks to something beyond $1,000 bonuses, boom, now they're going after guys in the fifth round with second round money to make sure that they don't go to college. You know, that's what really helped in a lot of cases. And when it comes time to make those deals to bring in talent, it happens. You know, they're able to go do that. And he's got as close to full autonomy almost, you know, without being the actual owner himself in Kansas City. And if he went to Atlanta, you would have ownership. You'd have Schuerholz. And right now, John Hart is technically the baseball or the president of baseball operations, whereas right now, Dayton Moore is vice president of baseball operations for the Royals. So if he went there to be their general manager, it would be basically a lateral move where he would still, one, he wouldn't have the direct line he really does now, and he'd be one spot removed, more or less, with Hart there. So it's not really a better situation for him other than maybe the talent base that he would inherit. So I can't see for that reason why he would leave when he has everything he could want in Kansas City and would basically have to take a demotion almost. Even if it's lateral, it's still kind of a demotion to be Atlanta's GM. So without the promise of actually like that president distinction, I just can't see it happening. Maybe somewhere else, if it was Seattle, that's possible. They're not going to make a move, but you know, any other opening that would happen. I also think there's kind of this knee-jerk reaction that, oh, it's Atlanta, therefore Dayton Moore will be a candidate. And he is a candidate for them, but I think it's just too easy and obvious to mention him because there is that former connection. So I can't see him going anywhere. I think more than likely, for a couple of years now, there's been some rumbling speculation. Clint Scholes has really been tooting this horn that they would promote Dayton Moore to president in some capacity and would promote somebody else up into the general manager spot. So it'd probably be Dayton Moore would be president of baseball operations, and then J.J. Piccolo would take over the general manager duties. And this is probably the time for the Royals to finally pull the trigger on that, unless they're prepared for Dayton Moore to actually go, which I can't imagine they will be. I figure Dayton Moore is going to be the Royals GM or a Royals executive as long as he wants to be, and as long as David Glass is around. And I don't know if that's the situation he would leave for, considering, you know, not only where he would stand in that new organization, but also just the chaos around it. Like, why would you want to go into that situation where you have these questions about some of your international signees, and why would you want to try to rehabilitate that image, you know, while you have to basically reacclimate yourself to, you know, this new position? So I don't see it happening, even if it is the second time that he has to say no to John Schuerholz. My gut just says, nah, he's not going anywhere.
Yeah, I'm inclined to agree with you. And Jeffrey Flanagan, who, you know, is definitely has his pulse on the thing. He's all in on Dayton Moore staying. He's very – the only even thing close to not staying that I heard is he Flanagan's admission that the only thing he's learned in his 25 years, I think he said, of covering sports was just that, you know, athletes and front office folk have the right to change their minds. But he goes, as of now and from what I know, it's not something that Dayton Moore would or will do. So, you know, and I'm inclined to agree with that. I think he'll stay, and you know, I think that's the most logical path, the one you talked about with him being promoted to. Ever since I first heard Clint kind of mention that as a possibility, I think it made a lot of sense because you know we've heard. Even before the World Series, I think Dayton Moore even kind of started saying, you know, after the first World Series, but before the World Series title, I think he even kind of started saying stuff to the tune of, you know, I don't know if I have the energy to go through this again,
right?
Doing a full rebuild. And I won't say it's full rebuild right now because they're, you know, leagues better than they were in 2006 when he came. But,
yeah,
you know, there definitely is a lot of work ahead of him if he wanted to try and get back to another World Series. So, and him, you know, he's made especially, you know, recently he's kind of mentioned how I don't know if I have the energy to do it again. Then it makes a lot of sense. There's been a lot of talk and there's been interviews of J.J. Piccolo that he's taken. He took an interview with the Astros a few years back for that opening. Was that with Jeff Lunau?
Yeah, that would have been when Lunau was hired.
And then the Phillies. Did he the Twins? Right? Did he?
I think he was mentioned as a candidate. I don't remember if he ever.
But he didn't actually interview.
They hired. There was some talk. They hired their replacement really quick.
Yeah.
After that, like it was like within a week they had a guy. I was like, oh, yeah, okay.
Yeah, there was definitely some talk, but yeah, the Phillies. So I mean, he's had interviews. There's been talk around the league and everything, and you know, it's always actually been kind of perplexing, especially after that World Series title.
I figured he'd have been gone by now. Yeah,
yeah. So I don't wonder if that's been the plan all along, and that they've both have known it, and that's kind of why he's sticking around, knowing that, you know, he'll get that opportunity when Dayton Moore decides to take a reduced role as a president or something. And we've seen that kind of scenario play out quite a bit before in different organizations. So, you know, it certainly is possible. I think it would be a very good move. And definitely, like you said, no better time than now, if that's the move you want to make, you know, let you still got Dayton Moore to be around for all the warm fuzzies, but it's Piccolo's organization now and he can make the changes he wants to make, because they're making a lot of changes anyway, whether it's Dayton Moore or not, you know, or right. Piccolo. And I guess we can kind of talk about that for a little bit as maybe our final topic here for the show, but because we kind of talked about, I think last week, didn't we, a little bit about some of the parting of ways, I guess you could say.
Yeah.
Dave Island is no longer the pitching coach now. He's gone. Don Wakamatsu, the bench coach, many people thought the leading candidate to supersede Trump. Or Trump. Ned Yost, sorry, I just...
Freudian slip.
Yeah, I saw something on...
I would vote for
Wakamatsu. Wishful thinking.
Anyway.
Wakamatsu 2020. Wow. Wow. Okay.
That's funny. I'm going to hashtag that later. So watch out for that, yes. Everybody, on social media.
Indeed. But as a leading candidate to replace Yost for the manager role, but with him being gone... Now it's kind of opened up that spot, and that's kind of where as Wakamatsu was the bench coach, that's kind of the, you know, manager in waiting role is the bench coach. So, you know, who's going to be in that role? And there is, you know, there was, because was, you know, it was, wasn't Leske the one that was saying like, okay, you know, Grifol might have been a good candidate, but since he's not selected for that now, it kind of makes him think that they had somebody in mind. And who is that person? You know, they obviously haven't hired anybody yet, but Dave Lesky had two thoughts that he had. One that I like, one that I don't necessarily like. I'll start with the one that I don't like, and that is Jason Kendall. Who's definitely been involved in the organization ever since he retired as a Royal. And you know, there's been lots of talk for a few years, even as he's been involved with the team, that they could be grooming him to become a manager. And then, so that one I'm not such a huge fan of, because I just don't really like Jason Kendall. I don't know that he would necessarily be terrible.
He'd probably be a pretty okay man. I mean, former catcher, good player, you know.
Yeah, just like Yost, former catcher. Very similar to Yost in, you know, came up as a catcher, like you said. He's got that same kind of old school mentality, it seems.
yeah, a little bit.
So
just a touch.
Just a bit. So who knows with that, you know, but that, I wouldn't be as huge of a fan, but I reserve the right to change my mind if things go well, if Jason Kendall were ever to do that.
Absolutely.
But and then the other one that I do kind of like is Raul Labañez, is a name that Lesky mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something I do like, that name. And, you know, there was obviously, you know, the famous speech in Chicago that Labañez gave that turned the franchise around, really.
Yeah.
In 2014, as they trekked the World Series that year, and then you know, he wasn't on the 2015 team, but of course we all know what happened there. So it's he would be a good candidate, I think. You know, he's someone who he's pretty, you know, he recently retired, so he's pretty close to the game. Still has a good feel for it. Seems to have a good rapport with most players. And I think kind of the precedent that the Royals have set, and now I'm always kind of the opinion that whatever your manager coach is, there's essentially two of them. There's your X's and O's guy, and there's your player's coach. You know, I mean, occasionally you can have that type of coach that is kind of all of them together. And it's maybe a little bit more of a distinction in football, but in football, I was always kind of the opinion that, you know, whatever your previous one was, you kind of want to go the opposite, because it's obviously not working for one reason or another. But I don't know if I necessarily think that's the same in baseball. And Yost, not really known for his strategery.
As he willingly admitted in the postseason press conference.
Yeah. But
he knows what his limitations are.
Yeah. And, you know, as far as the perception of Yost, I mean, there was the Orioles series in 2014 where it was the chess master and the dunce talking about Buck Showalter versus Ned Yost, respectively. And the Royals swept that series quite easily. So, you know, for whatever that's worth, I'm just throwing that out there.
Right.
But point being, Ned Yost's strengths were not his strategy, his strategic decision making, but was in his he was kind of a player's manager, and his ability to control the clubhouse, his ability to, you know, let the players feel kind of protected. He never threw his players under the bus. Always protected his players to the media. He never put his players in a position where the media could kind of manipulate them and get them to look bad. You know, I mean, sometimes, you know, inevitably it's going to happen. You can't protect everything, but he did his best to protect his players, and his players knew that he would go to bat for him no matter what. And that was his best asset as a manager. So, you know, having a, you know, I'm not necessarily saying that Raul Labañez would be that way necessarily, but as more of a kind of player's guy who can, who they would know kind of can, for lack of a better term, protect them, if you will, and won't throw them under the bus and won't sell them down the river and all that kind of stuff. And, you know, but at the same time, perhaps having some strategic limitations. And, you know, there's been no indication that Raul Labañez would be strategically limited. Who knows? Mm-hmm. But, you know, it wouldn't be a bad idea to stick with that method. So that's kind of my thoughts on the matter. I mean, you come out similar to where I am, or you feel differently about those two candidates or possible future?
I don't know. I mean, it has seemed like Kendall has been groomed to be the next guy in some manner, or Wakamatsu. He was always seemingly like a pretty good candidate. He's managed before. He's gone now. You know, he's probably going to come up as a managerial candidate for some of the other openings that'll pop up in this offseason too. So I don't know if it ends up being that Kendall's necessarily going to be the guy, but he's probably got to be the favorite. For whatever it's worth, you know, I don't know. I mean, he is very old school. But it does work out into the kind of point where Yost has, you know, this one more year on his contract. If that means that they hand it off to Kendall, then he's going to basically be in a similar spot that Yost was, where you're looking at a team of younger players in a lot of cases with a couple of veterans, and you've got to try to, you know, direct these guys how to win. You know, Ned Yost, this is his second managerial job. It would be Kendall's first, so that might change the approach somewhat. For Ibanez, it would be, I don't think he's coached at all, though, so that might be one thing that kind of works against him.
He was essentially a glorified coach in 2014, but that's the closest that he came.
More or less, yeah, that's true. So I don't know what that kind of means for him, but that doesn't necessarily mean that he can't do it. I mean, everybody has to start somewhere. And maybe Grafal would be a guy who would be there. You know, he didn't really do well as a hitting coach.
No.
But, you know, maybe that's just because his skill is not necessarily in hitting instruction. Plus, you know, the hitting coach is kind of, you know, there's only so much you can do sometimes. So it's maybe it's not fair to bother him. They kept him in the organization for a reason, so it may be to be one of the guys to take over for Yost when the time comes. So, you know, I don't see why they would change that much as far as approach. It might be that Kendall's a really good players manager because he is that old school guy. You know, he might not be a super gruff player like he seems as a manager as he seemed as a player. So it might be something that works out. I don't know. I thought of the same thing you did about like football coaches. They usually seem to go from like Wade Phillips to Bill Belichick. And it's like, okay, this guy's pretty chill and this guy's really disciplined. And then you just keep switching it. You know, I don't know if you necessarily need to do that for the Royals. You know, it always seemed like Ned Yost was the right guy to get them, to get those young guys ready and steered in the right direction. And then maybe there would be another guy who would be the more strategic, savvy guy later that would get them into the World Series. Turned out that, you know, Yost did fine on that front. So, you know, I think maybe that points to a lot of the tactical things that a manager does being pretty paint by numbers 95% of the time. And that 5% is where you get into maybe bullpen usage, creative lineups, you know, the increased use of shifts, things like that, you know, stuff that maybe is tailored more to one manager over the other. But a lot of it is the same manager is going to do the same thing in most situations. It doesn't really matter who's back there. And so that interpersonal stuff in the clubhouse really does matter. And I think, like you said, that's what really worked for Ned Yost, that he had extreme loyalty from everybody in that clubhouse. And, you know, that mattered in the end. So I don't really know if I have a preference or a choice. I assume it's just going to be Kendall. But, you know, if it's Ibanez, that'd be pretty cool too. And if it's Grafal, that'd be cool. Or it might even be like Vance Wilson, who's been kind of that guy for a number of years within the Royals organization as a definite future major league manager. So, I mean, I guess the good thing is they've got a lot of candidates for whatever happens. So that's not a bad place to be.
No, certainly not. And I think that's kind of all there is to be said. It's not a huge – Ned Yost already said he's coming back next year, which, you know, if you asked me a year ago, I would have said that's very surprising. So I was kind of caught off guard. I honestly thought he'd ride off into the sunset just like the rest of the Royals, but apparently not. So, you know, maybe – the only thing I can think of, you know, and especially with circling back to the Dayton Moore – possibly becoming a president and having Piccolo step into the GM role. The only thing I could possibly think of is maybe they just want to say, okay, I know we're going to lose these guys, but let's give it, you know, one more shot. Let's see if maybe we can catch some magic. Maybe we can who knows? And they look at, okay, the Twins didn't think they were going to compete this year. They even thought at the trade deadline they were out of it. And now look at, you know, they found themselves in the wild card game, even though they lost.
Yep.
So maybe that could be us next year. You never know. We've got enough pieces coming back that if things fell our way, I mean, these are things you can kind of convince yourself of, especially after you're still only 2 years removed from a World Series. So, that's kind of the only thing I can really think of, I guess, that would, if that is the plan for Dayton Moore to become president, Ned Yost to retire, you know, if that were to actually be the plan, then if they haven't done it at this time, which is the absolute perfect time to execute, you know, Order 66, any Star Wars fans out there, but if it's not now, then that's the only kind of thing I can think of, if that's still the plan, of why they would, why they wouldn't do it at this time. But who knows? I'm not them.
Yeah, a lot of interesting kind of stuff up in the air. There's a lot of, I wouldn't even say uncertainty, because I don't think anybody really strongly expects Dayton Moore to go. And there's been some national reporters who have said, "Oh, the leanings are that he'll go." And I'm like, I doubt it.
Yeah, like based on what?
Yeah, it's like, okay, I don't know who's leaking that to you, because the Royals prevent leaks in that front office about as well as any team. So I don't know who's talking, who has Dayton's ear on that, you know, significant of a matter. I just can't imagine it. Yeah, and then the managerial stuff is in there. I just keep flailing my arms around here, knocking crap over. I just can't imagine, you know, I'm surprised that Yost stayed, and, you know, I guess that was surprising, because I figured he would run off too. But yeah, there's some intrigue to that too. If there's a manager in waiting already in that dugout, and maybe we'll see some of that develop in the off season and in spring training. And then you've got all the drama of Eric Hosmer and the other guys. So there's just a lot of stuff that we're going to have to watch this off season.
And it will be kind of interesting, because a lot of these little things that we're talking about that don't have necessarily a huge impact on next season, outside of, you know, the players not being signed back by the Royals, it's going to have a huge impact for how this team is structured and what they're going to look like a few years from now. Because, you know, if those four players don't sign, and in all likelihood, Hosmer and Moose most definitely, and Kane probably will net them back draft picks, then that's going to be a big time deal for the Royals. It's going to help them replenish the farm system. And then whoever the new bench coach is, you know, there has the inside track at least on being the next coach, or I'm sorry, next manager of the team. And then, you know, whatever Dayton Moore decides his future is going to be. So, you know, this not going to have, you know, qualifying offers, draft picks, bench coaches, not a ton of impact on next season's team, but going forward going to end up being very important aspects of this organization that could be, you know, one of those picks could end up being, you know, Danny Duffy or Mike Montgomery, or, you know, players that
Sean Manaea was a comp pick. So
exactly. Yeah. You know, players that were in those first kind of 2-3 rounds that, had those, had an impact one way or another, you know, whether you're Danny Duffy and it's on the field, or whether you're Mike Montgomery who was used as part of a trade, or whatever the case may be, you know, there's a very good chance that a lot of those draft picks are going to have an impact on this team moving forward. So, it'll definitely be interesting.
Yeah. A lot of, just going to be a lot of entry, a lot of, you know, whatever. They're in such a weird spot, because I think they feel like they want to contend every year, and maybe they'll still be in the same kind of 80 win range next year. But there's all this other stuff that's going around too, where they're going to have draft picks available, and they've got some lower level players who are pretty good who might rise up. So, you know, in by the end of the year, by the end of, you know, a year from today, it might be, you know, there might be a lot of even more movement as some of those guys come up and other changes happen. So that groundwork's being set today, you know, over the next couple months. So that's what we'll watch for.
Yeah. And it'll be fun to catalog. And we will be here for all of it. And we will certainly have plenty to say, as we've had tonight. So just kind of touched on, went a little bit more in depth. You know, last week was just kind of a happy, you know, thanks for all the memories type of show. And now kind of a little bit more in depth about the impact of what these moves will have on this team moving forward. So we'll kind of end it there. And then next week we plan on, and reserve the right to change should something arise, but we plan right next week on going over the over-under that we had at the beginning of the season. If you'll remember, if you've been listening to the show, we made a lot of predictions. We had a lot of random stats. Not random stats. We, you know, we used Baseball Prospectus, a lot of the projections that they had, and we took those and said, okay, you know, over-under on particular people. We did a mid-season review a couple months ago, and we'll do the review finally after the season, and then we'll also go over the bold predictions we made. I know one I'm going to be very disappointed about. We'll tune in next week if you don't know exactly what I'm talking about. But we will go over all that, and that'll be kind of fun to see what the projections were, where they ended up, and where we thought they would end up last year. I know there'll be a couple that we will be way off on, and a couple that we may have wished we were way off on. But we're
right.
So tune in next week. We'll go over that. That'll be a fun show. As always, be sure to visit our sponsors, BP Kansas City. We're still, you know, no off season over at BP Kansas City. Still pumping out daily content. So be sure and go check that out. A lot of great writers, of course, who also never take days off, never have an off season. Lots of great stuff. Kelly's Well Sport Inn. Couldn't do it without them. They've been a friend so long of the show. If you're going to Westport or you know, you want to have a good time, be sure to visit Kelly's. It's a fantastic place. As always, though, we want to remind you to be very responsible when you do. We want to keep all of you as listeners. So when you go out and have some fun, make sure you be responsible. But also make sure you go to Kelly's, because it's one of the best, in my opinion. So with that, I think we'll leave you this evening or afternoon or morning or wherever you're listening to the show. So, and thank you so much for listening, of course, as we couldn't do it without you guys, all the listeners, and we love you all so much. And if you have anything you feel, since we're going to have a little bit more freedom on what to talk about in the show, if you have any particular topics or anything you'd like to discuss or you'd like us to discuss, you can hit us up with an email. You can hit us up on Twitter, Facebook, whichever means you're most comfortable with. But if you want something for us to kind of dig into and maybe talk about on the show, let us know, because you know, we obviously have our plan for how we want the show to go, but it's always nice to see what the listeners want and how we can incorporate that into the show. So if you have something, please don't hesitate. Whatever means you feel most comfortable with, let us know, and we'll see if we can work it into the show and go over it. So thank you all so much for listening. We will see you next week and all off season as we see this a new age for the Royals. We'll be back next week. And until then, thank you all for stopping by. We'll see you next week. And as always, go Royals.
Thank you for listening to the Kansas City Baseball Vault. You can follow us on Twitter at KC Baseball Vault. You can also find us on Baseball Prospectus Kansas City at bpkansascity.com. You can follow BPKC on Twitter at BProKansasCity. Also, you can subscribe to the podcast through iTunes, through Stitcher, or whatever podcast app you like. And if you have any questions, comments, or if you just want to say hi, send those emails to KansasCityBaseballVault@gmail.com.
Hey, Troy, what are you doing this weekend?
I'm going to grab a beer somewhere. What do you have in mind?
I heard about this awesome new bar downtown. It's called Rage. The waitresses have a contest to see who has the most piercing.
Oh, man, that's not really my scene.
Well, there's another bar close by called Spit Cup. Check it out. The bartenders wear chaps, and every hour they shoot a guy.
No, seriously, I just want a bar where I can sit down and watch the game.
Okay, I've got just the place. It's called Lilac. You sit on pillows, and you drink from eucalyptus leaves.
No, Ned, but I just want a place where I can get a cheap drink and watch the football game.
Okay, I got it. This place, it's got a TV. It's called 816.
Limogitosis.
Yep. All their drinks come in NBA hats.
Man, I just want a place like Kelly's.
Oh, you mean Kelly's Westport Inn? No, they've got all the basketball and bowl game. They've even got a heated roof. The view is really nice, too, if you know what I'm saying. Why didn't you just say you wanted to go to Kelly's?
Kelly's Westport Inn, 500 Westport Road. Make it your place to go any time of the week.